You're listening to the Fifth Estate podcast from the Wheeler Center. This week, Tom Porteous speaks to host Sally Warhaft about human rights and the coronavirus pandemic.
Tom is a deputy director at program director at Human Rights Watch. He formerly worked in journalism, in diplomacy, and United Nations peacekeeping. And some of you regulars to the Fifth Estate might remember Tom was with us in Melbourne 5 years ago now. And I remember the conversation with him really well. I remember him for his kindness and compassion and an incredible insight into the issue of human rights. And so it is just such a pleasure to welcome you back again, Tom. Hello.
Hi.
And you're joining us from Paris, and even better to have you there across the pond. If you can't be here, you were meant to be coming to Melbourne in late March, and you were going to be a guest here, and in particular to talk about the anniversary of the fifth anniversary of the war in Yemen. And I thought tonight we could just start by touching on that country, and because one of the things, of course, that happened with the coronavirus is that it swept everything else away, and crises and disputes and problems all over the world that have suddenly just seemingly disappeared. So I thought we could start with asking you, what do you know of what is happening in Yemen with coronavirus?
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, the crises have disappeared from our television screens and our newspapers on the whole, but they are continuing. So in Yemen, you still have war, you have humanitarian and economic crisis, you have a large population of displaced people living in precarious conditions in camps dependent on foreign aid for food and medical assistance. But actually, this aid has been much reduced recently. You have a collapse of normal public life, political life within the country, which is divided between the north and the south, competing political factions. You also have porous borders with immigrant flows from Africa into the Gulf via Yemen. And you have really a weak to non-existent health service. You've had recent flooding in some parts of the country, and you've got a long-running drought at the same time. So it's really like the four horsemen of the apocalypse. And so, you know, the country is really exhausted by years of conflict. So not only do many Yemenis have a sort of lowered physiological immune systems, but metaphorically speaking, the country itself has a very weak immune system and therefore is very vulnerable to COVID. It's very hard to predict, I think, what will happen in Yemen with COVID, because there's still an awful lot we don't know about the virus. There's also very little information coming out from Yemen. Officially, the infection and death rate figures for Yemen are still quite low relative to many other countries, but just in recent weeks, it looks like the virus has started to spread quite significantly. And there's a real fear that things could get very, very bad there because of the lack of any sort of serious health system. I think the main point here is that the COVID pandemic has a way of exposing the fault lines in societies, as well as in our system of global governance. And Yemen is certainly a very fragile fault line. And there are other situations of conflict political collapse where I think we're also going to see, if the virus takes hold, really serious problems. Syria is one example. Libya is another. And the list is really all too long.
The list of things to worry about in terms of human rights impact is also far too long as well. But what worries you the very most in regard to the coronavirus and human rights?
I think that there are sort of two big things that worry me. But also, I think that they are sort of opportunities for human rights. If I could start with the opportunity, and if you know, I think one can make a sort of an interesting analogy with the Great Depression in the 1920s. The Great Depression, you know, was a massive economic shock that triggered a change in thinking about sort of economic and social relations that led to the New Deal and the creation of the welfare state. Now, these developments weren't specifically framed in terms of human rights at the time, but nonetheless, I think they led to objective advances in economic and social rights during the second half of the century, when those rights started to be formulated and recognized in international treaties. So right now we're facing a problem with you know, the economic impact of the coronavirus, which could be enormous, but it could also be an opportunity for re-examining the social contract between governments and the governed, and to put in place a society that is actually fairer and more respectful of human rights. At the same time, the Great Depression obviously led to the catastrophe of the rise of fascism, military expansionism, the collapse of international cooperation, the Second World War, and all the horrors that came from that. And so I think we need to be worried and vigilant about the potential political fallout. And I think the role of all of us really in the human rights movement is to be doubling down, if you like, on the need for protection for political and civil rights in case that the shock that the coronavirus has created in the world leads to further political deterioration in the world, further rise of the sort of populist tendencies that we've been seeing recently, of governments that are turning their backs on human rights. So I think that, you know, we're really at a sort of hinge moment in history at the moment with the coronavirus, it's a moment where everyone has a role to play, basically to take sides and to start working for what they really believe in. Because, you know, to use that sort of rather overquoted phrase that I think is attributed to Edmund Burke, the Anglo-Irish political thinker of the 18th century, the only thing necessary for the triumph of evil is for good men to do nothing.
This emergence of the sort of nationalism, it was already there, of course, in many places in the world before the coronavirus hit. And tell us your thoughts, particularly in America with Trump. And are you surprised by what's happened with the devastating toll in the United States and the response to it? Can you talk a bit about that, but also how significant is that failure of leadership in the United States, in terms of the response of the rest of the world to the virus?
Look, am I surprised? I mean, I'm afraid I'm not that surprised. But you know, look, the United States is the richest country in the world with the most powerful military in the world, and yet it has the highest infection and death rate in the world. So I think it will take time and study to sort of really analyze why, but I mean, I think it's worth making a couple of points. First of all, you know, as in Yemen, the pandemic has exposed in the US some very serious pre-existing economic and social problems. And they have to do with inequality, really, And these, you know, predate the Trump administration. So you have inequalities based on social and economic status, on race, obviously, on gender. These are very historical problems in the United States. So as a result, the worst hit by the coronavirus in United States include a long list of people who are living in very precarious circumstances. And, you know, I've been living in the United States for the past 8 years. And, you know, I've been shocked, really, to sort of coming from Europe, where you have a fairly well-functioning welfare system. You know, in the United States, people are very vulnerable to the kind of shock that they're seeing now. Those on low income or part-time jobs, or without jobs at all, those living in precarious housing where sort of social distancing or working from home is next to impossible, where people are one paycheck short of eviction. You have women who may face increased risk of domestic violence under the lockdown. That's actually a problem that is not just in the United States, it's everywhere. People having even bigger obstacles than usual, juggling work with childcare because of the lockdown. People incarcerated in the United States, notoriously overpopulated and unsanitary prisons, undocumented migrants, many of whom the Trump administration has decided to deport on the pretext of protecting public health and American jobs. The more than 30 million people who have in the United States who've lost their jobs since the start of the pandemic. Millions living in the United States without health insurance, without savings, without a safety net. People who have pre-existing conditions like diabetes, high blood pressure, and so on, who tend to be poor and black. People who don't have access to good healthcare because of what you have in a system in the United States, which is a mainly for-profit health system that doesn't cater to the needs of the poor, and even many middle-class people. Kids for whom the lockdown means no education at all because they don't have access to the internet, the homeless, people living in care homes where standards of care are so bad that they amount to serious human rights abuses. So now the United States government, like many other governments around the world, has of course launched a massive spending program, can afford it, worth trillions of dollars to protect the economy in the face of the economic ravages of the pandemic. But guess what? You know, the relief packages have fallen far short when it comes to protecting the poorest and most vulnerable in society. So I think that, you know, worldwide, the virus has been an opportunity for countries to look at themselves in the mirror and to see themselves as they really are. And many countries, it's perfectly true, face, you know, similar and worse underlying weaknesses than the US does. But a lot of industrialized nations, like, you know, New Zealand or Australia or Germany, South Korea and others have actually come out of this looking pretty good so far. The United States is not so much the case. And there's a lot that really needs to be fixed. But the question is, you know, where's the political will to fix it? And so the second point is about the politics in the United States. And of course, while there have been some, you know, reasonably good responses to the COVID virus in the US, both at the federal and at the state level, there's a real problem, as you suggest in your question, with the current leadership. There are some sort of worrying pathologies that are developing in the US political system of checks and balances that have been, again, exposed and amplified by the coronavirus pandemic. And in the view of many commentators, these sort of augur pretty badly for the future of U.S. democracy. And one signal of this is the president's strategy, and I think it is a strategy, of responding to criticism of his performance by attacking journalists and undermining trust in the mainstream media in the context of a pandemic where access to, you know, reliable information is vital. This is particularly dangerous. Another thing to note is the president's tendency to directly contradict his administration's own guidelines, his public health officials, and even himself. And, you know, while this might just seem weird, in fact, the aim often appears to be consistent with the political strategy that he's pursued quite sort of consistently in order to stay in power, namely to appeal to his political base and to confuse and polarize and sort of gaslight the nation. I think that there are some real sort of issues with the U.S. leadership at the national level. And of course, at the international level, with the America First policy that the Trump administration has adopted since the beginning, the U.S. effectively has sort of removed itself from the role as the sort of, leader of international cooperation to deal with global crises.
The United Nations has, said that this is a crisis where, countries have to work together, that it's never going to be solved by countries, being individual countries. But I'm not sure how many people would actually be convinced of that at this point. It's the countries, of course, that have locked down and put up borders and worked alone that have been more successful. What's your sense of the role of the World Health Organization, the United Nations, in this pandemic, given the US has, vacated the field of leadership? China's in a strange position given, the attacks of the president and the xenophobia coming straight from his mouth. How have those institutions stood up in, their role to protect human rights specifically?
Yeah, the UN has obviously played a very important role, since the Second World War in a number of areas, including human rights and also in global health. The WHO is a sort of vital agency and the primary mechanism for international cooperation on global health issues. And it has a reasonable track record of addressing global health issues, including previous pandemics like Ebola and the SARS and MERS pandemics. The problem, of course, is that the UN is not, partly the problem is that it's a sort of heavily bureaucratic intergovernmental organization and therefore often slow to react. But more importantly, it's only as good as its member states will allow it to be, right? Traditionally it has relied heavily on, reasonably enlightened kind of self-interested but reasonably enlightened sort of position of the U.S. that it will take this role as the sort of leader of international cooperation. But as you say, that's sort of, pretty much absent now. And the UN is hampered by the absence of the US and by the emerging sort of competition between the US and China. And unfortunately, the WHO in particular has now in this crisis turned into a sort of punching bag for the Trump administration, which obviously, is seeking to deflect attention from its own shortcomings in handling the crisis at home. So I think that, if we sort of stand back a bit, the bigger picture point is that we appear to be entering into an era of global power competition, which makes, collaboration on major global crises much more difficult. And it makes it more difficult for the UN and its agencies to act effectively. And I think that, if we look into the future where we're going to see more shocks from climate change and other environmental problems, as well as, continuing problems of armed conflict and terrorism, and arms control, actually international cooperation has never been more important. So it's a real pity that we're seeing, a diminution of the of global leadership around international cooperation.
How does an organisation like Human Rights Watch prepare for the? You mentioned two possibilities at the outset of, you know, that you mentioned the New Deal, what came out of the 1930s of opportunities where in new ways of thinking economically and socially, the human rights messages at the core of, say, all economic decisions feels to me like we're a long way away from that opportunity right now. But if it's there, as you say, or a god-awful, you know, right-wing nationalism, how does Human Rights Watch prepare for the possibilities of those kind of scenarios? Or are you, in fact, just so in the moment of this crisis that that's for your spare time and not the job of the organisation?
We can't afford not to be focusing on those sort of bigger picture issues. I mean, obviously, we are in the moment. We've been producing, you know, a huge amount of information and reports and press releases and commentary on, you know, what's been going on throughout this crisis so far. But obviously, we're looking to the future. And we're looking to the future in a world of great uncertainty, including financial uncertainty. We depend entirely on private donations for our funding. So we need to think about that, because everyone is taking a hit, or most people are taking a big hit from the economic consequences of the coronavirus. But in terms of the bigger picture, we do what we always do. We kind of set our objectives, and then we work out what the strategy should be to achieve those objectives. So if one of our objectives is to take the opportunity of the coronavirus or of the economic impact of the coronavirus to try to come out of this encouraging governments to set about, you know, creating a new deal, a new social contract, we need to work out, you know, how that might be done. And I think it's not actually that far-fetched. I mean, people might be quite despondent in the current environment, but I think there are definitely possibilities here. There are opportunities for advocacy around creating a new social contract that is framed in terms of human rights, in terms of the right of all to health, to good housing, to water, to food, to education. And the reason for this is, I think, that people have actually seen how governments can really come to the protection of their citizens at a time of crisis. They've been spending trillions of dollars on measures to protect the economy, to invest in the health service, to protect jobs, to protect the social fabric, if you like. And so they've seen what they're capable of in a crisis, and it's likely that just as happened after the Great Depression, they'll want that to continue once the crisis has abated. So I do think that there are real opportunities here. Of course, there are obviously menaces as well. There's the threat of the rise of populism and how the economic impact of this could be very negative in terms of the political situation. I mean, just saw how the 2008 financial crisis was actually one of the things that sort of triggered the kind of populism that we've seen in the last 10 years, and some of those populist parties and leaders have taken power. So that is a real threat, and we need to have our eye on that, and we need to develop strategies to deal with that. And one of those is obviously to say to people and point out over and over again that the anti-democratic forces, the anti-science forces, these populists who are sort of so self-centered that they reject expert advice and so on and so forth. These very governments that are led by these kinds of leaders and political parties and political forces are actually not doing a great job in dealing with the crisis. I mean, Trump's poll numbers have gone down. And I think it's worth making that point and over again. And I think that, that there's a real opportunity there as well to actually use the coronavirus crisis to undercut, to undermine, to point out the flaws in this model of politics.
Perhaps too, there's an opportunity in wealthier Western democracies, but places like Australia, where perhaps many people haven't really thought about human rights affecting them negatively. That I mean, one of the things that's been really present here is the idea that the state can just shut you down and suddenly tell you who you can hug, who you can see, where you can go. These are experiences that most Australians have never experienced before. It's very strange to feel that. And so I suppose an awareness at the moment for millions of people that perhaps have never experienced that before is something that could be used as a memory of, this is what it feels like for the state to come bearing down on you. In this case, it's for the protection, the mass protection, but for billions of people in time, that state comes bearing down for much nastier reasons.
Yes, I mean, I think that most people in functioning democracies like Australia or here in France have accepted the need for certain restrictions. And, under human rights law, restrictions are possible and legitimate as long as they're proportionate and necessary and of limited duration. In order to protect public health. And I think people accept that argument. So I'm not sure that that this will be a particular lesson in democracies. And those who are living in non-democratic countries who are seeing, abuses, who are seeing their governments using the coronavirus as a pretext or a cover for continuing their abuses, they're just sort of, kind of, they've become used to that sort of thing. Mm. But I think that one of the things that is interesting is, and I think which we also need to underline, is how, whether you're in a country in lockdown or one that is now gingerly just coming out of the lockdown, human rights respecting approach to public health in the midst of a pandemic also happens to be a pragmatic and effective approach. So let me give you an example. A good public health policy requires, timely access to accurate information so governments can quickly respond to threats to public health. So suppressing speech about public health or legitimate criticism of the authorities is bad for public health. And the example of China immediately comes to mind, where initially there was all sorts of restrictions on access to information, and that actually helped the virus to spread. So denying people access to information about healthcare is bad for public health. Also shutting down the internet is bad for public health because people don't have access to the internet, and we've seen people shut down the internet in the course of this pandemic. Another example is protecting the right to privacy. That's also good for public health. So applications for mobile phones that could alert us if we're near someone who's found to have been infected by COVID will only work if large numbers of people, use them. But they're unlikely to do that if they feel that their governments are going to be abusing this kind of technology in order to create a sort of big brother state. Mm. And a third quick example, protecting the right of everyone to access to healthcare, regardless of where they come from, what their race is, what their gender is. That's good for health for everyone because the virus doesn't respect, social barriers. So any population that is neglected because it's a minority or whatever can become an incubator. And once the virus thrives in one community, it will cross into other communities. So, you know, access to healthcare for everyone is good for everyone.
Mm. Technology has been such a feature of this, and you know, whether or not you've got the internet, as schools, everything goes remote. What we're doing this evening, what people all over the world are doing, but also with the development of, you know, apps, I'm sure they must be there in France as well. In Australia, there's a COVID app, and about 6 million Australians have taken it up. What's your thought on that as a tool in the fight against the virus, but as a potential again for human rights abuses?
Right. I think that we're talking about a number of different technologies here. There's sort of contract tracing using data that's provided by telecom providers. There's Bluetooth tracing. There's mobile apps to enforce social distancing, to enforce quarantines, and then there's sort of big data analytics and so on. And the common denominator of all those technologies is location data that is collected on people's portable phones. The problem here is that the data usually contains quite sensitive information about people's identity, their behavior, their associations, and this can raise privacy concerns and fears of misuse of the data for all sorts of doubtful purposes. And there are also potential problems of discrimination because, as you mentioned, you know, there are vast disparities in people's access to technology and sort of digital literacy and so on that could exclude, you know, marginalized populations from public health responses that sort of rely too much on this kind of location tracking. As I mentioned earlier, I think this is partly a question of trust. There's absolutely no doubt that technology linked to phones and other technological fixes do have the potential to be of real help in dealing with the virus and contact tracing, quarantine enforcement, tracking the spread of the virus, even in the allocation of medical resources. But as long as people are worried about their privacy, there's unlikely to be enough uptake of the technology for it to be a really effective public health tool. So in order to gain the trust of populations, governments and tech companies need to show that they're really sensitive to these concerns and make sure that they demonstrate good faith in ensuring that these programs are, you know, equipped with the right kinds of safeguards to protect privacy, and that the data will only be used strictly for the stated medical and public health purposes, and that data collection will stop once the public health crisis is over. The guiding principles in developing and using these technologies should be that they are lawful, proportionate, necessary, and that they should be of limited duration. I mean, we woke up after the sort of the terrorism crisis of the beginning of the century to find that, you know, we were living in a surveillance society, and even after the threat had diminished somewhat, you know, the surveillance tools that were put in place then in the name of terrorism are still there. They're still with us. Cameras all over the place. And this is the next stage. This is potentially the next stage in creating the Big Brother society that I think is bad for human rights.
So what then are the most urgent things for now, really, as, you know, many countries are emerging out of the strict lockdown? Nobody really knows what's ahead. But what are the most urgent priorities then to protect people at the moment?
Well, I mean, I think that there are a number of big issues that have come out of this as we've talked about, as I've said several times already, that the COVID crisis has had an interesting way of really sort of revealing the fault lines in society.
It's like every country has played to its character, isn't it? I mean, even Australia is a very obedient country, despite this myth that we're a bunch of larrikins. We're actually really obedient. We're the first country in the world to wear seatbelts compulsory. We're the first to give up the cigarettes. We pretty much do what we're told, and there's a contract in that there's an expectation that citizens will be generally looked after. It's served us very well, that characteristic, for this particular crisis. It seems to be true of sort of everywhere, doesn't it, that the cliches, there's truth in a lot of them for how each country has responded.
Yes, but you know, the point I was getting at is, and you know, even in Australia, you know, we've seen examples of this, you know. You know, the virus has given rise to some pretty unfortunate behaviour. Mm. You know, yes, there's been many examples of solidarity and cooperation and good neighbourliness and so on. But you know, take racism for example. There have been increased incidents of sometimes really violent, you know, anti-Asian racism, mm. scapegoating, and xenophobia just on the basis that the virus originated in Asia. We've collected a large number of incidents of this kind from Europe, from the Middle East, from Russia, from the United States, and from Australia. Mm. You know, fortunately, the Australian government has responded with, you know, the Prime Minister making very appropriate criticism of this kind of thing. In the US, it hasn't been quite as good, and Trump has insisted on calling the coronavirus the China virus, which hasn't helped matters. And of course, this kind of scapegoating is not just limited to Asians. It, you know, in every country, it's exposed the sort of racial and ethnic divisions. In India, hate speech against Muslims has grown, especially after the Indian authorities announced that a large number of Muslims had tested positive for COVID-19 after attending a mass sort of religious ceremony in Delhi. In Sri Lanka, we've seen similar stigmatization of the Muslim community. And in the Middle East, we've seen scapegoating of migrant workers who live in these kind of, you know, quite unsanitary conditions, which have been a sort of incubator for the coronavirus. You know, so, you know, we've also seen a rise in misogyny and sexism. There's been a massive increase in domestic violence mm. worldwide. You know, that's been a sort of hidden, horrible fact of life, but suddenly it's kind of like out there in the open. The virus has also been used as a pretext to deny women access to reproductive health care, including safe abortions. And also, actually, the coronavirus has exposed a sort of and exacerbated an appalling, but up to now quite hidden, sort of attitudes towards the elderly, the way the elderly are treated in care homes and so on. The Brazilian
the price on life, you know, the idea of I mean, there's always been a price on life. It's not talked about, is it, in economic decisions, but the way the elderly have been discussed and treated has been a spectacular feature of this.
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, all countries obviously are facing this kind of balancing act between protecting lives and protecting the economy. But putting a price on life may be something that's useful for risk analysis or for sort of other actuarial purposes, but it's really not useful for the political discourse of this moment, or for formulating a route out of the crisis, mm. or a roadmap for reordering the world that we want to come out into, right? As I've already kind of said, you know, a much better way is to look at the situation, bearing in mind that really, and I think this is borne out by some of what we've seen in the last couple of months, is that a human rights respecting approach to public health, including respecting the human rights of the elderly, of the marginalized, of the poor, of the vulnerable, is in fact the most also the most pragmatic and effective approach to dealing with the health crisis.
So do you achieve that through, you know, what are the steps? How do you get that language to remain a part of political conversation where human rights, these things that are apparent at the moment, remain in a conversation for rebuilding economies and rebuilding broken lives all over the world?
I think it's... You know, first of all, you know, I think the human rights discourse, it has now acquired very deep roots in political discourse. There surely have been some challenges of late with the rise of anti-human rights, you know, movements and political parties and leaders, and some of those parties have got into power, even in Europe, where you have the Hungarian government that is basically assumed dictatorial powers to deal under the cover of and on the pretext of dealing with the coronavirus. But I think I go back to the point that I was making earlier, that if we can really point out how badly those kinds of governments have managed, how incompetent they've turned out to be, because to the governments that have turned their back on science, that question, you know, the mainstream media when it comes to when they start to kind of raise really valid concerns about performance, the performance of these governments. If we can point out how badly that model of politics has worked in a big crisis, I think we're actually, you know, in good shape, because as long as democratic governance continues to operate, you know, there is a chance that those people will eventually be kicked out of power.
Some of the democracies, though, too. I mean, it's been such a challenge, hasn't it? For, you know, France, where you are, United Kingdom, I mean, America. This is, you know, the virus doesn't seem to care what sort of a political system you have at all. And I mean, the outcome in November in the United States, of course, will be all important, I would imagine, from a human rights perspective in how that country, but also the rest of the world, the kind of lead that they're going to take from the outcome of that election. Is it as important as I'm making out, or could I be overestimating it?
I'm sorry, could you...
The importance of the election in the United States in November, how important is that going to be to rebuilding not just that country, but in terms of the rest of the world and rebuilding, you know, human rights, getting through this crisis? Is it really crucial who wins that election, do you think?
Look, I mean, a lot of the problems in the United States predate the Trump administration. A lot of them are structural issues. I think what's important is that the democratic process in the United States is seen to be fair, I mean, that's the bottom line. There has been some worrying talk about, you know, postponing the election. There have been some worrying signals in that respect. There's been worrying signals from the administration about sort of casting doubt on the legitimacy of postal voting. There's the whole history of voter suppression in the United States. which is very concerning in the current context where people might not even be able to get out to the polling booths if there's a sort of second wave around November. But look, I mean, I think people will... Look, obviously the coronavirus and the government's response to it, which has not been brilliant up until now, will be a defining factor in November. And we'll just have to see what happens.
What would you expect to play out with the availability, if there is a vaccine, how the world goes about distributing such a thing if it's discovered, which is still a big if?
Look, I mean, we go back to the point that we were talking about before about international cooperation. I mean, that's obviously going to be critical in terms of bringing vaccines to poorer countries. Unfortunately, look, just last week, the WHO adopted a resolution promising international cooperation to provide vaccines at affordable prices by limiting patents. This resolution was proposed by members of the WHO, including Japan and the European Union and Australia. But the resolution was non-binding, and the US, as we know, has threatened to withdraw funding from the WHO. The US had nothing to do with proposing this resolution. So the fear is that, you know, the drug maker that develops the first coronavirus vaccine, be it a company from the US or China or elsewhere, would monopolize the market via its patent. And setting the price too high would make it almost impossible for poorer nations to afford the vaccine. And you know, the virus is spreading quite rapidly in such nations now. Of course, there's also the issue of access to a vaccine at a national level. In countries where the authorities are held accountable and where there's a functioning public health system that can deliver vaccines according to the needs and priorities, that shouldn't be a problem. But where there's weak accountability or weakened accountability, and where the health sector is mainly run on private lines, there could be real problems with poor and marginalized communities not getting access to a vaccine. Or you can imagine an even worse situation where, you know, certain political constituencies are not getting access to vaccines because the government, you know, wants to sort of punish them for their political views.
Mm. Look, I've got to say, I find it hard to be optimistic about the, you know, when you gave those two possibilities at the outset, and I'm pretty concerned, I have to say. Your background, Tom, is in the classics. You studied at Oxford University. Before our time runs out, I would love to know, you're in France, in lockdown. What have you reflected on from your classics readings, and what are you reading at the moment?
I suppose one classical author who comes immediately to mind is the great Greek historian Thucydides. His history of the Peloponnesian War between Athens and Sparta had relevance for me when I first read it as an undergraduate at Oxford during the Cold War. Because he has such a brilliant analysis of the relations between these two antagonistic states on the Greek mainland. And it has real relevance today as the sort of tectonic plates of world power shift. And he also has this extraordinary account of the plague that hit Athens in 430 BC, I think. It killed the Athenian leader of the time, Pericles, and it eventually contributed to the weakening of Athens and then Sparta's defeat of Athens in the Second Peloponnesian War. Athenian power never recovered, and the stage was then later set for, you know, the subjugation of mainland Greece by the Macedonians the father of Alexander the Great a century later. Another of my favorite classical historians is Tacitus, who was a Roman senator who wrote a history of the early Roman emperors in the first century AD, after the disintegration of the Roman Republic. And his descriptions of the psychology of tyranny under the emperors Tiberius and Caligula and Nero are completely fascinating. And there's much, I think, to be learned about our current predicament for reading, you know, these classical historians. On a more personal level, you know, the meditations of the Roman emperor Marcus Aurelius, and I think his Stoic philosophy, you know, provide a really useful set of spiritual tools for the world that were that was then entering the Dark Ages, and for the world that we're living in at the moment. Although I think I'm more optimistic than you. In terms of what I've actually been reading, you know, I think many people have actually taken the opportunity of the lockdown to read Albert Camus' La Peste, The Plague. And each time I read this, it's, I get new insights. And for me, the message that came through this time was the sort of the message that is put into the mouth of the protagonist, the doctor, Rieu, who says at one point that the only way to fight the plague is through decency.
Well, I think we should just end it on that glorious note, Tom, and your optimism. I'm glad you are a bit more, perhaps a lot more optimistic than I am. I'm feeling better after our conversation about the possibilities than I was before, but we'll have to wait and see. It's been 5 years since we last talked before tonight. Perhaps we'll have to set another date for perhaps in 5 years from now, and you can come back to Melbourne, and we'll see how it all turns out. But all the best to you, and our gratitude to you for tuning in this morning, your time to give us your insight. It's been such a pleasure to see you again.
It's been a real pleasure for me too, Sally, and just, you know, stay optimistic. I think that this is a real wake-up call, and I am optimistic about the future.
Good. Well, thank you. And thank you too to everybody who's tuned in to listen. And we'll see you in 2 weeks when my guest will be Kevin Rudd. So that will be something to look forward to. But Tom Porteous, thank you again. It's just been such a pleasure.
Thank you.
Tom Porteous and Sally Warhaft speaking on Tuesday, the 26th of May, 2020. In a fortnight, we'll hear from the Asia Society Policy Institute president and former Australian Prime Minister Kevin Rudd on the diplomatic minefield set by the pandemic. Visit wheelercentre.com to find out more. Until then, take care.